Welcome to City Arts and Lectures, a season of talks and onstage conversations with some of the most celebrated writers, artists, and thinkers of our day, recorded before an audience at the Sydney Goldstein Theater in San Francisco. This week, disability activist Alice Wong talks to comedian W. Kamau Bell. Wong is founding director of the Disability Visibility Project, an online community dedicated to creating and amplifying disability media and culture. This year marks the 30th anniversary of the Americans with Disabilities Act, a landmark civil rights law whose purpose is to ensure that people with disabilities have the same rights and opportunities as everyone else. Protections similar to those provided on the basis of race, sex, and religion. Wong has edited an anthology of personal essays by contemporary disabled writers to mark the occasion. On October 19th, 2020, Alice Wong talked about the book with her good friend, comedian, and journalist W. Kamau Bell. The two also spoke about the extra challenges faced by disabled voters during the time of COVID, the importance of abled allies advocating for the disabled community, and their shared admiration for Denzel Washington. Join us now for Disability Visibility with Alice Wong and W. Kamau Bell.
How are you doing, Alice?
I'm alive, Kamau. How about you?
I feel similarly. How are you doing is such a loaded question in the 2020 pandemic, social unrest, election era. But I would imagine also as a person with disabilities, that it's always a loaded question. So how are you doing in this doubly loaded time?
Yeah, I feel like it's a lot. Not just disabled people, but I think so many marginalized communities are just, you know, at capacity in terms of just the unending kind of existential threats to our existence. So there's that, but I think at the same time, you know, there are pockets of joy and, you know, pleasure and just abundance. There's a lot that still gives me hope. And I think, you know, it's a very weird time to have a book out, but I think it's also a great time because we need culture, we need, you know, something to keep us going and just keep us engaged and thinking. So, you know, it's not highlight, but great to be talking to you.
I mean, I think what you said is so right. Maybe it is a strange time to have a book out, but it seems like a great time for a book like this because many of us who are not disabled are thinking about accessibility, healthcare, how to navigate the world in a way we weren't thinking about it before. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about what have you seen as far as non-disabled people sort of going through things that you feel like people with disabilities go through all the time?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, like, you know, I did have to kind of laugh and, like, you know, privately guffaw because, you know, when the lockdown first happened, especially San Francisco was one of the earliest cities in the country to have this, you know, shelter in place order. You know, people definitely freaked out. I mean, I think for the first time nationally and globally, you know, I thought disabled people had something taken away from them. And that's the thing I'm talking about is convenience. The thing I'm talking about is, you know, their privilege to take up space, to navigate any space they wanted. And they're like, what? How is this happening? I just, what is this thing called Zoom? And, yeah, why do we have to be more flexible? And I think this is there's a really kind of bittersweet feeling about this, not just by me, but just by a lot of other people who are, you know, traumatized, traumatically ill, housebound, you know. Folks have been like, we told y'all, and we've been doing this for years, if not decades, y'all. And it's like, you finally got the memo, but that that accessibility matters, that's having different options in terms of online and in-person. You know, I think there's another thing that just kind of drives me up the wall is the, you know, the fact that suddenly people realize, like, time should be elastic. That, you know, capitalism just really done a number on us in terms of how do we think about work? How do we really get our needs met and are there for one another in new and different ways? So if there's any sort of silver lining to come out of this, is the fact that I do hope that workplaces, cultural institutions, you know, everyone and everything, think about the ways they can integrate flexibility and accessibility going forward. And I really want to give a shout out to like City Arts and Lectures for just having me on. I think it's pretty significant to have a disabled activist slash writer slash editor part of the series because I'm not a highfalutin literary person, but I think it's very significant to have that.
We can talk about how we met if you want to tell that story. I'll happily be a part of that. But also, I think that I remember that when we talked, I think it was for United Shades of America, which you were on, the idea that like the things that make the world more accessible for disabled people make the world more accessible for all of us. So at the time we talked about curb cuts being a thing that like every parent with a stroller or even people who are just walking and just want to use curb cuts are a thing that we don't realize are there because of the ADA. And when you say captions, I think about the fact that like I have become the person who uses captions all the time. And it does make my life watching movies and TV easier. And that wouldn't be there if not for the disability activism.
Yeah, and I feel like this is another, if we want to talk about allyship, you know, I say that with air quotes and a lot of side eye. But, you know, access should not be, you know, the responsibility of disabled people. Like this is, there's one thing that's, that all disabled people should do is to say, hey, I'm going to be at this event. Will there be interpreters? Will there be captioning? You know, or that's, let's say there's a panel on diversity. You as a non-disabled ally, you say, do you have disabled people?
You can ask. I hear you.
There's a lot of ways people can just speak up and just not place it all on us.
Well, I just realized I'm going to be at City Arts and Lectures again with the Department of Journalism from UC Berkeley. And I don't know if this is my official rider, but I'm going to ask in my rider right now. I know City Arts and Lectures is listening. If I can have interpreters and ASL interpreters on the and a captioner. So thank you, Alice, for calling me out, subtweeting me and calling me out right now.
See what I did there? See what I did there? And this is what it takes. I mean, this is, maybe I'm the virus. Maybe I am the virus that you've always been looking for to come out. And I'm happy to infect you. In fact, I'm infecting everyone right now. You know, because let's face it, there's a lot of ableism out there. And maybe this virus will undo it. Maybe there's a metaphor there somewhere.
Do you want to tell the story of how we met?
Sure. And it all starts on a little bird app called Twitter. Now, I think you and Kevin Avery, you know, podcasting and having this really delightful series all about Denzel Washington.
Yes. The podcast was called Denzel Washington is the greatest actor of all time, period.
Period, with a DT, period.
Yes.
So my friend, Adam Hartzell, who follows you, you know, he was listening to one of your episodes, and you two were talking about the Bone Collector, and I think either you or Kevin mentioned, like, maybe we should have the same person talking with us about this movie. And then Adam was gracious enough to tweet you and tag me saying, hey, I have a friend, SF Direwolf, that's me. And then that's how we got connected. And I had a great time. I think maybe your podcast, I don't think it's one of the first, but you know, I wasn't really a guest on a lot of podcasts, but I think I had a hilarious time talking to you about it. I mean, what were your thoughts about that?
I mean, I loved how it came together, the fact that it was through the Bird app, because I have to be reminded sometimes that good things can happen from the Bird app. And so I loved how it came together very organically. And then you came on, and as you just did when you just told me to make sure that City Arts and Lectures has captions and ASL on my next event here, you did that same thing where you sort of like a Jedi, walked me through and explained things to me, and then sort of let me answer the questions for myself. Like in The Bone Collector, Denzel Washington is confined to a bed, and you talked about all the machines and things he had access to, and you said he's one of the 1% of, he's like a 1%er disabled person. And I had never thought of that before, about like, not every disabled person would have access to all that equipment, and how the movies made him have more access, but also didn't let you know that that's not how all disabled people are living. So
yeah, I mean, the thing that I loved about that film was, you know, number one, Denzel is awesome. You know, clearly he's awesome, and the fact that he is able to fight back.
Yes, yes.
I mean, he has a great, like, chomping on somebody's neck is wonderful. I mean, I'm all for that. But I do think that one of the things that also was resonated to me was the fact that he had, you know, home health aides seemed to be 24/7.
Yes.
And I was like, this is not exactly, you know, what a lot of people out there do need assistance. That's not the reality. And I think that was a very Hollywood thing, I think.
Well, I think the thing that you are so great at is sort of taking these opportunities and turning them into teaching moments. And I see you do that on Twitter all the time. And also finding in the big news story, the thing that is not being covered that can sort of address and sort of connect to the people with disabilities. And your book, Disability Visibility, is all about that. And even in the way you put it together, you could have just written a book yourself. You know, you could have just said, I'm going to write a book about my life and my experiences. You could have done something selfish, like I did. But what you did instead was to curate a book. Why was it important to do that instead of just writing a book yourself? You curated a book with different voices in it.
Yeah, I think that, first of all, I don't think I'm all that interesting, to be honest. And I think
I would disagree. I don't want to interrupt you, but I disagree.
But I think, one of the things that really gives me joy, to be honest, is really the fact that there are so many amazing, brilliant, creative disabled people out there. And it gives me joy, but also part of my rage, the very real rage, is the fact that most people don't really know about them. And I think, you know, what did I do to flex my power and privilege? You know, when I did get this book deal, it was, you know, somebody from Vintage Books. Her name is Catherine Tung, T-U-N-G. She emailed me out of the blue in December 2018 saying, hey, you know, do you have any interest in editing anthology? And I'm like, well, yes, I do. Yes, I do. And I think that's, you know, these are the kind of opportunities that I know don't come around very often. And speaking of the Bird app, I think maybe that's how she found out about me, because, you know, people just tend to follow and just, you know, I get myself out there in different ways. So I'm grateful for that as well. It's not all just a dumpster fire, even though barely social media is, but it has brought me together with other people and given me a platform. It's a very real platform. And I don't take that for granted. But I think, you know, what I really wanted to do with this anthology is just give a snapshot of the incredible diversity and range of views, and really a snapshot of the here and now. So these are stories published within the last 20 years. And I think to me, that's really important because we need to talk about what is currently the passions, the work, the issues, the everyday lives of disabled people. So, you know, I do hope that this book really encourages people to dig deeper, to want to learn more, and discover more. So in the back of the book, I have a reading list and resources list. So for the people who are just new to disability, you know, just to disability culture or disability community, I do hope this is a stepping point, a jumping point. And for those who are already part of the community, I hope that they feel seen and heard, and that they feel like, wow, this is something for us and by us. Because to me, that was the objective, first and foremost in my mind, that the audience, that the work is really centered on us. Because it's still a rarity, and I think, you know, I did kind of use my Jedi powers in the, you know, introduction. You know, I called out the publishing industry. You know, I'm like, why is it that here we are in 2020 and there isn't a disability specific imprint at one of the major five publishing houses? I mean, there's, I want to see more disabled writers be published, but also disabled editors, disabled people in publishing to have the power to greenlight these books, because really that's where you're going to get the most authentic and most interesting pieces, because being an editor gives you a lot of privilege on the choices you make. And I was very intentional about the pieces I selected.
You said something very interesting there. You said, and we've talked about this before, the idea that if anyone is new to the community, the disabled community, and I think that the thing that I learned from you is that if we feel new to it, those of us who are not disabled, it's because we're not paying attention, mm-hmm. or because we're ignoring. Mm-hmm. You know, that, you know, as it says on the back of the book, one in five people in the United States live with a disability. They're not all visible, as also is covered in the book, but just the idea that, like, those of us who are not disabled, I would say we run away from thinking about this. What do you think about that?
Yeah, that's very real. I think, you know, I feel like it's a little bit basic, but I think, you know, stigma is still a thing. It's just, ableism is still a thing. It's, you know, ableism is enmeshed in our everyday lives, the same way white supremacy is. I mean, to be honest, I mean, they are really intertwined. And for people who want to, who are working on unraveling and unlearning white supremacy, I also welcome to assign you to unlearn ableism. And that's something that we can all do, not just not disabled people, but disabled people as well. There's internalized stuff that's can really do a number. So there's a lot of work that can be done, but I think it'll all get us to move toward justice. And I think that's, in the end, the goal. At least that's my hope.
I think it's a worthy goal, and I think you're working very well towards that. So I think the idea that ableism is a part of white supremacy, as far as I can tell, because when they say white supremacy, they don't mean, they're not including disabled people in white supremacy, just like they're not including Black people in white supremacy. Mm-hmm. And as the book points out, you can be both. You can be a person of color and disabled, as you know.
Yeah, and I feel like, especially in this pandemic time, you know, we've seen so many people survive COVID, but they are going to be new members of the disability community. So it's 1 in 5 now, but, you know, pretty much we're going to see an entire new generation of people with really long-lasting, permanent, you know, consequences of this virus. So that's something to really think about, too, that, you know, whether people realize it or not, everybody knows somebody with cancer, with asthma, with diabetes. I mean, whether people are thinking about it or not, they are connected to disability. And that's, again, like every single political issue is a disability issue, just like every single issue is a Black issue, right? Like it's, I think we've got to really go beyond these silos and binaries and just, you know, just burn it all down.
There are no more binaries in any issue. It's yep. something we can learn through the pandemic.
Yep.
So I love the book. I haven't said that outright, but I want to be clear about that. I love you. I also happen to love your book. These two things can be true. I think the thing about the book that is so impressive is because it is many different voices. It's even though it's not a thick book by size, as I hold it up to demonstrate that it's not thick by size, it is a thick book by ideas, but it also is very, it's well put together, well written, it's entertaining, it's even when it's troubling, it's entertaining, and just the variety of ideas, it's quite an accomplishment to pull off. And yet at the same time, it is not, as you talk about, disability 101. Talk about pulling all that off.
Yeah, I mean, I think part of I guess it's really so much of my life I didn't realize led me to this moment. You know, the fact that I have admired a lot of people, a lot of work by disabled people. I've been tracking what Margie face, you know, like a fan. Like, I just, at the heart of this book is really, I've mentioned this at other events, but this is a big step. This is a Valentine that I want to share with people. Because these are things that I love. These are people I love and admire. So, you know, I've just been kind of, you know, slowly, just quietly collecting these words. And then, you know, in the creation of this book, I had a huge spreadsheet. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, my goodness. But, you know, these really were, I think, selected intentionally to give, you know, people just a range and a taste of what's out there. It's just different kinds of stories, you know. It's like, these are all disabled people, but they're not necessarily talking about disabilities, you know. They're just talking about their lives, their work, their passions. These are activists. These are scientists. These are parents. These are, you know, all kinds of people. And I think that's, you know, part of the purpose of this book is just to really blow people's minds and their preconceptions of what kind of stories are out there, because there's so much more depth and nuance. And I think especially, you know, mainstream media, I mean, it's very basic, you know, these overcoming or inspirational human interest stories. Or, you know, often the other stories about tragedy, pain. You know, it's not all about trauma. It's not all about suffering. And, you know, let's also face it that, especially in journalism, and again, with your upcoming events with the School of Journalism, you know, where are the disabled journalists? Why aren't there more disabled journalists out there? Because they are out there, but are they in newsrooms? Do news organizations actually have a disability beat? Do they think about the disability community as one of the many communities that are not reflected in their demographics and in their profession or even in their coverage. I think one of the things that really annoys me is the fact that so many stories, especially the news, you know, that's about disability is through a non-disabled lens. Some of the leads or like titles, you know, I just shake my head. I'm just like, oh, you silly ableist rabbits. I'm just like ready for a media takeover by disabled journalists. That is the goal in my mind. That is one of my goals. Not so secret goals.
I have to say one thing I think we have in common is that that we are both powered by rage, but people don't realize it. Like, because of how we present ourselves and how we put ourselves out in the world and how we turn our rage into other things. But I think I've always noticed that about you, is that we're both, I hope that's okay to say, we're both powered by rage.
Absolutely. I mean, I think, but the rage is always, I think, told through comedy. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, I don't, just like you, I think, you know, ranting or just lecturing people is not going to cut it. Mm-hmm. You know, I do think that storytelling is incredibly powerful, but also laughing about things, mm-hmm, and poking at the absurdities and just asking good questions. Like, I'm just basically a curious cat. Like, that's basically what I am about a lot of other things, but like asking good questions, see the funny part of like the darkness and the absurdity is a way to get through. Because I think if we can't laugh, it's a survival thing, but it's also a way, I think, to help kind of change minds.
I think that's true. I agree. One thing that's important about what you said about a disability takeover of journalism or the media, let's say the whole media, I want to join you on that goal.
Yeah.
Is that one thing you talk about in the book is disability is not a monolith. And if you have a disability takeover in media, it automatically isn't a monolithic takeover because it's LGBTQ+, it's every race, it's every religion, mm-hmm, just by nature of the fact that disability affects everybody.
Yeah, everybody are like a part of every community. I think that's just a thing. Just like, I do think that, especially with like activism and social movements and, you know, social justice, there's a lot of people that, you know, don't even realize that there are disabled people part of their movements. That there are ways that, especially with activism, that needs to be more accessible and inclusive. That's it's not all about, you know, rallies and marches. It's about how do we open the ways up for people, for everyone to participate. I think that to me is also really important, especially in this year. And as we are now about 2 weeks into this election day.
Were there any essays in the book that surprised you or that you were taken aback by, or? Or favorite essays?
Well, I will say that I wrote this in the introduction, but, you know, I was very deliberate about the very first essay. It's by Harry McBride-Johnson from 2003 in the New York Times. And this is an essay that was really personal for me, because when I read it, it's just, you know, I was just like, you know, squealing internally and just cheering in there. I felt so sad. Like, it was in the New York Times. I think that's another thing too, that there was such a powerful look for peace about her everyday life and her interaction with, frankly, a philosopher who believes that disabled infants should not live. I mean, this philosopher who is really well known, who is just has all the platforms and all the accolades, he's straight up championing genocide and eugenics. And, you know, these ideas are not relics of the past. You know, these ideas, just like I said about white supremacy, these are just interlinked. You know, the fact that some people are still not seen as human. Some people, especially let's face it, this pandemic, are seen as disposable. So we see people, I mean, the fact, it just drives me bananas that it's a, like this pandemic for people to realize that medical racism exists. That, black and brown and indigenous people disproportionately impacted. Why is that? Is it part of the genes? No, it's not. It's about the system. It's about racism. It's about colonialism. I just, you know, find it so, like, it took us this long. It took people. It didn't take us, but it took people, the broader people, to finally kind of wake up to it. So I think it's also a time to also link all of these things with also ableism, the fact that we have this pandemic, we have all these discussions about, oh, don't worry, it's only those people, those high-risk people, they're the only ones that are going to like be the most impacted, which we know is a lie. We know that's now a lie. And, oh, you know, prisons and charges of cities, you know, there's outbreaks everywhere, but, you know, we still need safety. We still need to keep people incarcerated because that's the way it's always been. No, it's not. Right? Like, abolition has been something that people have been working towards for decades, if not longer. So there's so many things that truly show in very explicit ways now how some people are just not valued. And I think this is an indictment on capitalism as well, right? This whole push to restart the economy. At what cost? Exactly, right? Like, do we expect all kinds of people who are higher risk to be definitely at home, you know, just to tell you straight up, I mean, I have not left my house once since mid-March.
Wow.
And, you know, and the way things are going, I don't think I will be unless absolutely necessary until late next year. And the only time I'm going to go out is coming up later this October, and that's to get a flu shot.
Wow.
You know, I mean, just like, I am keeping my fingers crossed that number one, that my wheelchair and my equipment does not break down. And number two, that I don't have anything urgent medically that I have to go see the doctor. But also, just like, I can't believe it, like, flu shot, that's gonna push me to venture out, but for a little, it's gonna be through drive-thru. I am not going inside anywhere if I can avoid it, but this is gonna be my reality for a long time, and this is the same for billions of people around the world. And the fact that so many people who have survived COVID-19 will need so much support and understanding, and just, you know, there's going to be a lot of people who, Yeah, do not feel safe. I don't feel safe.
You said so much in that, and I think I want to highlight the idea that you said you haven't been out since mid-March and don't know when you will go back out again except to get something medical that you need, a flu shot.
Or something, you know, desperate. Like,
yeah.
If I have to do something, maybe I have to, but I'm going to try to avoid it.
And when you say all that, it reminds me of the other reason that as an Asian person, it's dangerous to be outside. It's because of the way in which the president, I was going to say our president, but he's not you or my president. The president of the United States, Donald Trump, has targeted Asian people, not he's Chinese people, but therefore Asian people, because racism knows no ethnicity, and blamed Chinese people, Chinese for the COVID-19 virus, therefore blaming all Asian people. And there's been an uptick in hate crimes against Asian people.
Yeah, I mean, this is a great kind of time to question who is an American. It's still our image, or not ours, but the broader public image. The default is still a white person, right? Mm-hmm. And that everybody else is, you know, open to interrogation. The fact that, you know, so many Latinx people are just told to go home. I mean, like, that, mm-hmm. California, I live, this is my home. Mm-hmm. You know, Texas was part of Mexico, that's home. Mm-hmm. I mean, we kind of forget about that, right? And mm-hmm. it's an all-out kind of, you know, assault on who belongs. If I, and again, this is an administration that showed in their rhetoric, but also in their policy changes, for example, with immigration, that what kind of people do they want? And what kind of people count? You know, there was a public charge rule that was recently passed by the Homeland of Department of Homeland Security, I believe, but yeah, basically they've restricted the kinds of good immigrants that they want. Mm. Right? And one of the aspects of the public charge rule was they were not going to allow immigrants with significant disabilities to be able to utilize safety net programs. So, you know, that is straight up xenophobic, racist, mm-hmm. and ableist. Mm-hmm. So, you know, so many of these things are all connected. But yes, I think there's a lot of anti-Asian violence and harassment, but this is also, you know, so, you know, parallel and connected with anti-Muslim, anti-Arab, you know, just anti-Black, mm-hmm. you know, anti-Indigenous. It's just, it's all part of this larger tsunami of hate.
Tsunami of hate is a perfect way to describe it. Unfortunately true. I want to sort of step back a little bit. We talked about some things before we got on, and it's interesting. There's been, I'd say it's like, maybe it's called the Scarlett Johansson phenomenon. Yeah. Of Scarlett Johansson. I think it's happened more than once. Being cast to play roles that are completely not her. And some people push back. One was a trans man, I believe, and one was in Ghost in the Shell, clearly an Asian character, Japanese character. And there's sort of the idea of, like, one, an actor should be able to play whatever they want to play, and two, well, also, these people who are these people don't get enough roles, so we should let them at least audition for them first and see if they, you know, and really see if we can find somebody to play these roles. You don't hear as much about this with able-bodied actors playing disabled characters. What are your thoughts on that?
Yes, this is a very evergreen and hot topic about disabled people, because, you know, every time there's a movie, You know, for example, the one with Brian Cranston and
Kevin Hart.
Yes.
Yes.
What is it called again?
I can't remember. It came out at the same time that Kevin Hart was fired from the Oscars or quit the Oscars for saying anti-LGBTQ stuff, or they found some tweets he had said. And so I don't think he even remembers the name of that film.
Yeah, this is a film that's based on a French film. And, you know, the same people had thoughts, right? Like they were on Twitter, they were critiquing this. And so many people pushed back saying, "Don't you're stuck with their creativity. You know, how dare you?" And the fact that, again, this is a matter of gatekeeping and historic, you know, discrimination and systemic inequality. So how else can you push for these things to open up? You have to do it by, you know, pointing this out and just say, we need at least a chance to get through the door. We need more people who are not white cis men running Hollywood, right? I mean, this is part of the work, and you know, it's still unbelievable, like how low the bar is, you know, just the conversations about this, because there are talented people. There are so many talented disabled people of color just try so hard to be really pushed out of the industry due to the racism, due to ableism, due to just all these excuses, like, oh, these sets are, you know, built this way, it can't be accessible. Well, you know, we've seen what can happen when you face a pandemic. And people are forced to change. Like, suddenly, museums and, you know, all kinds of cultural events are suddenly accessible. Suddenly, there's live streaming of performances. You know, there are ways. And I think this is a failure of imagination. It's a failure of political will. It's a failure of leadership, right? Like, just that every single industry, especially the entertainment industry. So I think that's part of the thing that I've seen where a lot of people just not waiting around. They're going to do their own thing. And I think that's really exciting. But also, I think it's still important to push, you know, poke people and just bring these things up because it's still important to make sure that Hollywood and other big industries are ultimately accountable. And I'm here for the tragedy.
Well, you have had this effect on me. Whenever I'm watching movies or TV and an actor comes on playing with a disability, I immediately go to my phone and Google that person to figure out if they actually have that disability. So you have awakened me like that. And because of the idea of, like, why didn't this role go to someone else? So thank you for that.
And I do think this is part of the wonderful movement and changes that actors of color, trans actors, I mean, this is really part of progress, and that disabled people are part of this. And, you know, if we want to really show solidarity, we're going to also talk about disabled actors too, right? Like, things are definitely getting better. Like, you know, there are more stories, more shows, more movies, but it's still workflows. We are still workflows to parody. So there's a lot of more work to be done. And, you know, I do hope that there's going to be more kind of cross-community solidarity and support for one another as we break through these ceilings and gates and whatever metaphor you want to use.
So we have some audience questions we can go through. In talking about your activism, someone wants to know, when did you start your activism / become a public voice for disabled rights?
Well, many, many, many moons ago, baby was born, and she was disabled and adopted to the world. Mm. So I would have to say that I didn't have a choice to be an activist. I did have to start with speaking for myself, speaking, advocating for myself, which is what I did for a long time. But it wasn't until I think when I was in high school, a little bit of college, where I realized that I'm part of a larger community that had a history, because I really was kind of isolated from it. And again, this is why representation is so important, and why we need to kind of think about what histories are told, whose histories are told, because clearly disability history is not part of high school or grade school or middle school curriculum. So, I never knew that. I never had these frames of reference. Mm-hmm. So once I honestly became politicized as a young adult, that's when I started venturing out and getting involved in activism. But it took me a long time because I really was somebody who I thought was going to be an academic. I thought I'm going to be a scholar. That's the way I will contribute by, doing research about disability. But, I got caught up with things and the rage. It's been a very strong evolution, but I'm definitely more comfortable now. But it took me a long time because I didn't think I was activist-y enough, And I think that's what gets me angry too, is that everybody has the capacity to be an activist. You just do it in your own way. You do it whatever works for you. So there should be no dogma about how to do it. That's what kind of is my other annoyance.
I like what you said, that everybody has the ability to be an activist. I think in this time right now, especially, again, post-COVID, post-murder of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor and Rashad Brooks and others, and right within days of the election, I think we can say now, we all have to figure out things we can do to get this country back. Well, get this country on a good track. I don't say back to anything, but get this country on a good track.
Yeah, and I think that, I just wrote an essay recently that's probably published this week or next, but, it's about kind of about this moment, about the election, but also about my very kind of ambivalent feelings about voting, because, I am definitely voting, but I also recognize so many people cannot vote. Right, and I don't think voting is the only way to make your voice heard. And I do think that there's a lot of messages out there that prioritizes voting as the thing that you have to do. And if you don't do it, somehow, you're apathetic. And I think it's really important to think about how do we make sure that there's all kinds of ways to be involved? Because there's still a lot of people that just don't have that right. Can we expect, everybody has that right, but that's not true at all.
Are there ways that able-bodied people can do more to make voting more accessible in this upcoming election or any election that is happening?
Well, I think it's really tough right now because if it's allowed in your state, I think maybe dropping off an absentee ballot for a neighbor or a friend who did not get to a drop-off space you know, people's rights. You know, those are all part of this. But I also think that it's so tough right now because there are states actively suppressing the vote. I mean, it just boggles my mind about that, the fact that Georgia, Texas, you know, other states, they're eliminating, reducing polling places. They're limiting to one drop box per county.
Yeah.
It's, I mean, like, what? Mm-hmm. Like, mm-hmm. So there are a lot of attempts to suppress the vote that also is a real decrease in accessibility because, you know, we should not be crazy to voters who are voting early who have to wait in line 6 hours.
Mm-hmm.
And this is not the way the system should work.
Mm-hmm.
Voting should absolutely be easy peasy and come in always, right? Like every kind of option. So it's really, I think the turnout, early turnout is wonderful, but it also makes me really sad to think that people are so scared validly that their vote won't count, that they're willing to risk their lives. I have a disabled friend in Texas who, because of these new draconian rules, she is high risk, just like me. She said she's going to have to go out with her attendant to vote in person. Mm-hmm. And this is just wrong, the fact that people are going to have to risk getting affected to vote. And the voting should be safe. Voting should be private. The voting should be independent. You know, people should be able to do it independently without any assistance or just with assistance that's not required. But just nobody should be forced to vote in a way that takes away their privacy. And that to me, this is where we still, you know, have such a long way to go.
No, I think that I was thinking about Boots Riley, who I did an event with him years ago, and he said people try to convince you that voting is like the most you can do. And he said, well, voting is actually the least you can do. You should vote. Voting is a part of it. But as you said, we should be finding ways to be activists every day. That it's, we can't wait every 4 years to voice our opinion. We have to voice our opinion every day as much as we have the ability to. And then they're going to note your opinion every time there's an election, but we should be voicing our opinion all the time.
Yeah, part of it, I think, is just being informed and having conversations with people and just learning. I think that's, you know, part of the work that we all should do every day is just to remain kind of receptive to ideas that make us uncomfortable, ideas that are new to us. And then just try, you know, to keep an open mind. And I think that's part of the work.
So we talked about this on United Shades. It's a very common question, but I want to give you an opportunity to talk about this here. How do you feel about the term disabled?
Oh, well, I love it. I love it. You know, there's a lot of baggage and, you know, there's a lot of people that do have disabilities that will never use the word. You know, again, it's not about shaming or enforcing anything. You know, this is something I claim for myself and myself alone. I mean, there's all kinds of ways to be yourself and to be your true self. So, you know, disabled, I'm Asian American, I'm a woman, I'm a night owl, you know, I have lots of faith. And I think that's, you know, again, this identity politics is not a PC thing. It's really part of something that we should think about, that we should embrace. Because I think sometimes identity is part of the process of how you present yourself to the world, you know, the communities, the representative communities you're a part of, and also just, you know, be who you really are, who you want to be. And I think it's reclaiming the language or, you know, identities that have been, you know, for the most part suppressed because of the traditions we're living in. So it delights me when there are people that, you know, language is going to be evolving. You know, identity is evolving. There's so many different communities within the disability community. They're constantly kind of updating their language, how they talk about themselves. And that's a collective act. Like that's how culture advances. I'm all here for it.
I think to truly be progressive, and I've learned this through my time trying to, or to truly be progressive, you have to be excited about regularly updating your language and behavior, and you have to be excited about making real apologies where you fix the harm you caused. Otherwise, I don't think you're actually being truly progressive.
Yeah, there are a lot of these, let's face it, so-called good progressives that are super racist and ableist. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if we're going to get maligned again, if I don't, if it's okay, you know, there are, I think we've talked about this, talking to our sheets. I mean, there's so many ways to push back against the person occupying the White House. Mm-hmm. That doesn't require fat-phobic jokes. That doesn't require ableist jokes. Mm-hmm. You know, all of these conversations about the way he presents, the way he moves, you know, say for the other mm-hmm. candidates. Well, there's been a lot of attacks on him based on his stutter mm-hmm. or his age. Mm-hmm. And I think there's just like, we can be more destructive mm-hmm. and creative on how we want to, you know, respond and critique people. But let's not punch down. There's so many more. There's so many really sensitive ways to really call them into account.
Well, Alice, as we knew, the hour would fly by. As we said at the beginning of this, we've already gone over an hour. But I just want to give you an opportunity, if there's any question I didn't ask you, that you something you'd like to cover, or any final words you'd like to leave us with, I'd just love to give you the opportunity to say what you need to say. Because as we said at the beginning of this, and you said this before we got on, City Arts and Lecture is not something that all of us thought we would do automatically. You know, I felt the same way you did. I never pictured myself as a City Arts and Lecture person, and I've been privileged to be invited to do City Arts and Lectures several times. And so you will be back, I'm sure of that, but I want to give you the opportunity to say anything you need to say as we close this out.
Yeah, I would say that, you know, thank you to City Arts and Lectures for having me on, but also the fact that I really do hope that after the pandemic that we don't return to normal, that cultural institutions and all these other groups, everything that you've learned to adjust to this new reality, that you carry it forward. For example, you know, remote work, you know, different ways you connect with people. I think it'll only broaden your reach. It'll also bring you to people that you weren't able to have in person. You know, just speaking for myself, you know, this was almost the perfect time for me to have a book tour because, just to let everyone know, like, I don't travel, I don't fly, and I totally thought I would be at a disadvantage. You know, before the pandemic, I was, you know, thinking ahead, just worried about all the kind of work I would have to do, the emotional labor of asking groups to, like, give venues to say, hey, can we do this online? Did I do it with all the skills? Did all the things that I learned to pivot? And they will continue this. And yeah, that's my hope.
Thank you so much, Alice. And I will I will be in solidarity with you on the more virtual events. So I don't, because that helps me as an able-bodied person not have to travel too. So I appreciate you saying that. Yeah. So once again, what makes the world more accessible for you makes the world easier for me. So thank you for this. Thank you. I encourage everyone to buy Disability Visibility. I'm holding the book up. It's edited by Alice Wong, my friend, my mentor, my Jedi, my coat puller, and my rage partner.
Thanks, everyone.
You've been listening to Disability Visibility with Alice Wong and W. Kamau Bell. This program was recorded on October 19th, 2020. The two spoke to one another via video conference. These broadcasts are produced by City Arts and Lectures in association with KQED Public Radio, San Francisco. Executive producers are Kate Goldstein-Breyer and Holly Mulder-Wallen. Director of Communications and Design is Alexandra Washkin. Production and Communications Assistant is Juliet Gelfman-Randazzo. The Post-Production Director is Nina Thorson. The Sydney Goldstein Theater Technical Director, Steve Eckard. House Manager, Lucy Faulkner. The Recording Engineer is Jim Bennett. Theme music composed and performed by Pat Gleason. The Founding Producer is Sydney Goldstein. City Arts and Lectures programs are supported by grants for the arts of the San Francisco Hotel Tax Fund. Additional funding provided by the Wallace Alexander Gerbode Foundation, the Mimi and Peter Hawes Fund, the Bernard Osher Foundation, and the Friends of City Arts and Lectures. Support for recording and post-production of City Arts and Lectures is provided by Robert Mailer Anderson and Nicola Miner. To attend a live program, see who is coming next, or find out more about our podcast, visit our website at cityarts.net. That's cityarts.net.
Special thanks to Anne Oyama for making our programs possible as we shelter in place at home.